her to an art supply store in Fort Lauderdale. She bought an easel, a drop cloth, a roll of canvas, stretchers, gesso, brushes, several tubes of cadmium, alizarin and cobalt paint, and two cartons of titanium in pots, one bleached, one unbleached. He lifted the cartons out of a shopping cart and set them on the counter for the cashier to ring up. "What's with all the white?" he said. Sally raised an eyebrow. Her hair was tied in a scarf patterned with blue and green Matisse cutouts, and she was wearing a faded shirt with a button-down collar, blue pinstripes on white. The collar was unbuttoned enough to betray the scalloped lace trim of her brassiere. "Think I'm just going to come out and tell you," she said, "just like that?" It had been years since my grandfather had been competently teased by an attractive woman. This turned out to be a thing he had not known that he was missing.
"Is it a secret?"
"Of course it's a secret. Don't you know anything about art?"
"Art Carney."
"Oy! You promise no puns."
"I know next to nothing about art."
"Even I don't know the reason why all the white. That's how secret it is."
They drove back to Fontana Village, and my grandfather helped Sally carry her supplies into her house. The still unfurnished guest bedroom had a sliding glass door that filled it with morning sun. They put all of the supplies in there in an orderly jumble. Sally laughed her raucous laugh.
"This is such bullshit," she said.
"Come back in 2 weeks. I guarantee you it'll all be sitting there like that, untouched."
"So long as you don't go untouched that whole time."
"My God, you are such a pervert. Stop. Go kill your snake."
"No."
My grandfather put his arms around Sally's hips and pulled her toward him. She was wearing a pair of loose white pasha pants with an elastic waistband. His hands plunged past that and the lace waistband of her panties. He availed himself of two handfuls of her ass. It was not an inordinately large ass, yet the heft of it seemed to connect him to an immense source of gravitation, one for which he was belatedly grateful, as though for a long time he had been weightless and drifting.
"I was planning to feed you first," Sally said.
"All right," said my grandfather.
He reached out with a foot to hook the canvas drop cloth, bundled into its plastic package. He slid it across the floor and eased himself down onto it, kneeling on this impromptu cushion at her feet.
"Good Lord," Sally said, and then, "Oh, my."
He pulled down her pants and panties and contemplated the graying hair that thatched her belly. It grew sparse but long and very soft against the fingers. He put his cheek to her belly. The soft, gray-blonde hair rustled in his ear. The smell of her cunt reached his nostrils, not yet familiar, no longer strange. He tried and failed to compare it to the remembered smell of my grandmother's cunt. It had simply been too long, too goddamn long.
"Feed me," he said.
"No puns,"
Sally reminded him, lowering herself with a certain careless care onto the floor of the borrowed condominium.
"You promised."
Chapter 21 My grandfather took Diddens to see the rocket in the clearing and reported the basic details of its location and condition. He indicated that he planned to act on further V-2-related intelligence without mentioning von Braun and left Diddens in charge of bagging and tagging the rocket for shipment west. He left Diddens in ignorance of his actual plans as much and as long as he could. He told himself he would move faster and smarter alone. But the truth was that he was grieving for Allenbaugh, and like a lot of grieving people who keep a habitual distance from their emotions, he thought that being alone was what he needed. He shook hands with the old people in turn. He put two cartons of Chesterfields and a cigar of unknown provenance into the old priest's hands. The priest kissed my grandfather on the cheek and blessed his journey in rapid Latin. Fräulein Judith received two cans of sweetened condensed milk, a box of saltines, and the February 7, 1944 issue of Life, which had mysteriously appeared in my grandfather's rucksack the day after he and Allenbaugh followed the 104th Infantry into Köln. The cover was a picture of George Bernard Shaw. In return, my grandfather received a cold stare, a granite handshake, and a small, dusty wheel of cheese. "What the hell?" Diddon said. "Where are you going?" He had woken feeling tender and green at the gills, but having thrown up a few times in the pigsty, polished off the last bottle of wine, and had a tramp through the woods to see the magnificent beast of legend, he seemed back to his old, querulous self.
"I'll be back," my grandfather lied. "I just want to have a look around. You wait for the transport crew to show. Help them get the firecracker loaded."
My grandfather had given Diddon's credit for the find. It was the arrow in the foot that led them to the priest, who had led them to the V-2.
"You have a job to do," Diddon's warned my grandfather. "Only reason you're here in the middle of all this shit."
"I'm going to get that Von Braun," he said. "That's my job."
"Yeah? What are you going to do when you find him, eh? Kiss him on the lips?"
He put on a Southernville voice.
"Sweet burner, baby, your rocket gives me such a hard-on. Let me suck it."
"Probably."
"Oh, Werner, your Vaughn is so brawn."
My grandfather never saw Diddon's again. He walked out of the farmyard and down the road as far as the first crossroads. Almost immediately he heard the rumble of engines and the crunch of a truck transmission being skillfully abused. Two half-tracks, an armored car, and a deuce-and-a-half mess truck belonged to the 869th Field Battalion of the 65th Infantry Division rolled past. They had become separated from the rest of the division in the night and were heading to Paderborn, where the cooks riding in the deuce-and-a-half had orders to provide every GI they could find with a pancake breakfast. Paderborn was more or less on the way to Nordhausen, the last known whereabouts, to my grandfather at least, of Von Braun. My grandfather climbed into the back of the deuce-and-a-half with sacks of flour, stacked cartons of powdered eggs, 2 steel drums of corn syrup. He fell asleep before he could even finish cautioning himself not to fall asleep. When he woke up, the truck was grinding and bucking, and he could hear the driver swearing up in the cab. When he'd flagged down the deuce-and-a-half, my grandfather had noted the insignia painted on its front passenger door, a red spot on a gold shield. Beneath this, a legend crudely lettered in white paint informed the curious that this truck, whose name was Big Leg Woman, had been driven continuously since June 1944 from Omaha Beach to the Ardennes by Corporal Melvin Fish of the Red Ball Express. Corporal Fish would be accustomed to driving on fucked-up roads by now, but this one seemed to be giving him trouble. My grandfather poked his head out of the back of the truck. It appeared that some brave tactician had decided to toss a stray unit of motorcycle infantry over his shoulder to cover the SS retreat from the neighborhood. 2 or 3 dozen bikes with sidecars, a couple of squat Kubelwagens, a unit of 105mm priests on a hilltop to the west had caught the German cyclists on a stretch of open ground. For 100 yards, the road was a chicane of wrecked machines and dead men sunk in a churn of mud. It had not rained for several days, and this was not natural mud. It had been compounded by truck tires and caterpillar treads from dust and blood and whatever homebrew sauce the Krauts were putting in their engines as it leaked from busted fuel tanks to puddle in the ruts. There was hair in the mud. The soldiers, insofar as my grandfather could distinguish their features in the impasto of their bodies, had been the greenest of boys. For the moment, my grandfather was more interested in the condition of the motorcycles. Even before the artillery got to them, they must have been a sorry sight, fruit of the scrapyard, hybrid freaks. Bicycle parts pressed into ad hoc service, a sidecar that seemed to have been formed from a galvanized steel washtub, tires piebald with patches, bicycles, arrows. Soon they would be throwing bricks and rocks. They were already throwing the bodies of their children. A little way up the grassy slope that had served the gunners for a bowling alley, a German officer sat on his bike. As Big Leg Woman skidded and fishtailed past him, his left eye seemed to fix on my grandfather, hanging out of the back of the truck. The right side of the officer's skull and most of his face, apart from the staring eye, had been shot away. A spray of fine hair clung like dry grass to the blackened cliff of his parietal bone, fluttering in the breeze. His caked boots were planted solidly on either side of what appeared to be a nicely intact motorcycle, low-slung and painted an incongruous shade of khaki. He had a grown man's build, broad shoulders drawn back to lend his posture a hint of defiance. His gloved fists were locked around the grips of his motorcycle's handlebars. Maybe he had peeled away from his unit up the rise, hoping to draw the fire of the guns, or had hoped to rally his teenage fusiliers for a suicidal uphill charge toward them. As the convoy of trucks weaved and ground their way through the wreckage, one of the GIs predictably took offense at or could not resist the remnant of that blonde head on those arrogant shoulders. He drew his Colt and took a few half-hearted potshots, to no effect. Then he got serious, and the head burst into red mist. The carcass with no head stayed smartly upright, straddling the motorcycle. My grandfather jumped down from the back of the truck, sinking into the grim slurry to his ankles. Like the mud itself, the stench of the mud was an amalgam only war could concoct. Like the smell when MP delousing crews made POWs take off their clothes and boots, and the rancid butter gas of unwashed feet combined with armpit and the naphtha burn of bug spray. My grandfather found Corporal Fish's puzzled face in the right-hand rearview mirror. He waved his thanks for the lift. The road sucked at his boots. He reached the shoulder and scrambled up to the headless officer. A dense mesh of flies busied themselves in the air just above the decapitated stump as if attempting to weave themselves into a makeshift head. Apart from the stump, which revealed more than my grandfather cared to learn just then about the structural anatomy of the throat and upper vertebrae and the appetite of flies, there was nothing to suggest that the officer, a lieutenant like my grandfather, was prepared to relinquish the motorcycle. Even without his head, he maintained his rigid posture, his air of having dug his heels in.
"Enough already," my grandfather said. "We get it."
He took a breath. He worked his arms around the upper torso from behind, turning his face away from the meat and the frenzy of flies. Powerful impulses of his nervous system urged him just to yank the carcass loose and drop or even hurl it to the ground. He forbore. He worked the hands free of the grips with a few gentle twists. He eased the carcass off the seat, hoisted it up, and swung it until the farther leg came away free. He laid the body supine on the grass like he was helping a drunk to bed. Still holding his breath, my grandfather stripped the body of rifle, cartridge box, and gloves. Black leather gauntlets, heavy and cuffed, very Nazi. He pulled them on. The black leather was spattered with blood. He wiped his hands on the dead officer's uniform trousers. He went back to take a look at the motorcycle, a Zündapp. It was filthy, but appeared to have been well-maintained. It was an uncomplicated machine, engine and gearbox hung on a skeleton like the spread finger bones of a bat. A shaft drove the rear wheel and, he noted, the sidecar's wheel. Ignition on the gearshift mount. 4 speeds. Canvas cover over the sidecar as if the late operator had been accustomed to solitary rides. Apart from the black rubber grips, the seat and tires, and the steel caps of the jerry cans, the whole thing was painted a matte shade of desert tan. Stenciled on the nose of its sidecar, a cute little white palm tree hid modestly behind a white swastika. The Zündapp had an air of misplacement. A Central Park polar bear in August. In 1990, as in 1945, my grandfather was willing to devote a minute to pondering the mysteries of the Zündapp's journey from the Maghreb to the Westerwald, and the long downward journey of the Wehrmacht itself from the days of Rommel and the Afrika Korps. He climbed on. The driver of a passing Willys tapped his horn, and my grandfather lifted a gloved hand. He sat a moment, coming to terms with the bulk of it between his legs. He turned the ignition switch, opened the throttle, stepped on the kickstand. The engine rattled to life. Within 10 miles of setting out, he had fallen in love. He had driven a motorcycle only once, for an hour during which he never got comfortable on the BSA belonging to a pool player from Jersey. He remembered contending with alarming phenomena of pitch and torque. There had been a constant sense of lurching. Vibrations were transmitted directly to his bones and joints. This bike, poised on and steadied by its third wheel, just went. It flowed through upshifts and hugged the road in tight turns. The engine was loud but did not weary the ear. The ride was bouncy but not jarring. The fuel tank between his thighs was nearly full with potato peel ethanol or distilled shoe polish or whatever it might be. It was an excellent machine, though it had done nothing to help its previous owner hold on to his head. Later, my grandfather would remember thinking, as he headed for Nordhausen, that he could not wait to show it to his new friend Werner von Braun. They would tool around the autobahns of a post-war Germany, von Braun riding in the sidecar like a gentle-natured bear. Was he still there?
No.
No? He was gone by the time I got there, long gone. But you found him. He didn't answer. He was sitting up, face angled toward the window. His breathing looked steady, but it was past lunchtime, and he had not eaten anything all morning but a few bites of Jell-O. I figured he was feeling a little weak. Grandpa, you okay?
Fine.
Want a little soup? Ma made you some. He kept his eyes on the window as if something interesting were happening at the bird feeder. Out of my line of sight, another doomed attack by the Momser. Only he wasn't smiling.
I'm talking too much, he said after a while.
I'm sorry, we can stop. You should rest. Rest your voice. He made a face, dismissing the suggestion. He was not talking more than he had voice or strength to handle. He was talking more than he believed to be wise or suitable. Since, in his view, he reached the limit of conversational daring at the end of a 3-minute jeremiad on the world's failure to recognize the superiority of the Wankel rotary engine. I didn't take this admonishment or self-admonishment too seriously. I felt like it was, if anything, a tad melodramatic. I'm glad you're talking, I said. Melodrama was all right with me.
That's just why I shouldn't be.
What? Why?
You're too glad.
I'm too glad?
Too interested.
Oh, no, I'm bored out of my skull, I said. Really, I'm just being polite. On the street, a crew was topping trees to open a view for somebody higher up the hill. All that afternoon, a chainsaw started, stopped, started again. Views in the Oakland Hills are graded on a scale of visible bridges from 1 to 5. The San Mateo, the Dumbarton, the Bay, the Golden Gate, and the Richmond. My mother's living room and bedroom scored a respectable 2. From my grandfather's bed, however, the only visible span was the swag of black coaxial cable strung from a corner of the house to a telephone pole up by the street.
"You think this explains everything," my grandfather said.
He freighted the word "explains" with as much contempt as it would bear before exiling it from his mouth.
"Me and your grandmother, your mother, my time in prison, the war."
He turned from the window. In his eyes, through the haze of hydromorphone, I saw a flash of something I took, based on the historical record, for anger.
"You think it explains you?"
"It explains a lot," I said.
"It explains nothing."
"It explains a little."
"It's just names and dates and places."
"Okay."
"It doesn't add up to anything. Take my word for it. It doesn't mean anything."
"I get it," I said.
"Oh, you get it? What do you get?"
"I get that you're a big old fucking nihilist." That raised a smile, or maybe the Momser was back. "Richard Feynman," I said. "Dr. Richard Feynman."
"What about him?"
All he wanted was to find the answer to the question, why did Challenger explode, right? And that answer was never going to be because it was all part of God's plan, or, I don't know, Challenger exploded so that some little kid somewhere would get inspired to grow up and become an engineer and invent a safer, more durable propulsion system for spacecraft. Or even like, because humans and the things they make are prone to failure, or shit happens. The explanation was always going to be something like, because the weather was too cold, so the O-rings became brittle and failed, and fuel leaked from the fuel tank and ignited, which caused the shuttle to accelerate beyond its intended structural tolerance, so that it broke apart. The answer was always going to be dates and names and numbers. And that was good enough for Feynman because the point was to find out. The meaning was in the inquiry.
It was a solid rocket booster, my grandfather said, not the fuel tank.
Right. He kept on looking at me without speaking. But whatever had blazed out through the cloud cover was gone. A tear rolled down his cheek and he turned his face to the window again. I got up and pulled a Kleenex from the box. I started to try to wipe away the tear, but he pushed my hand aside. He took the Kleenex.
I'm ashamed, he said.
Grandpa,
I'm disappointed in myself, in my life, all my life, everything I tried. I only got halfway there. You try to take advantage of the time you have. That's what they tell you to do. But when you're old, you look back and you see all you did with all that time is wasted. All you have is a story of things you never started or couldn't finish. Things you fought with all your heart to build that didn't last or fought with all your heart to get rid of, and they're all still around. I'm ashamed of myself.
I'm not ashamed of you, I said. I'm proud.
He made another face.
This one said that what I knew about shame, what my entire generation, with its deployment of confession as a tool for self-aggrandizement, knew about shame, would fit into half a pistachio shell. Anyway, it's a pretty good story, I said. You have to admit.
Yeah?
He crumpled up the Kleenex, having dispatched the solitary tear.
You can have it. I'm giving it to you. After I'm gone, write it down. Explain everything. Make it mean something.
Use a lot of those fancy metaphors of yours. Put the whole thing in proper chronological order, not like this mishmash I'm making you. Start with the night I was born, March 2nd, 1915. There was a lunar eclipse that night. You know what that is? When the Earth's shadow falls across the moon?
Very significant.
I'm sure it's a perfect metaphor for something. Start with that.
Kind of trite, I said.
He threw the Kleenex at my head. It bounced off my cheek and fell on the floor. I bent to pick it up. Somewhere in its fibers it held what may have been the last tear my grandfather ever shed. Out of respect for his insistence on the meaninglessness of life, his, everyone's, I threw it into the wastebasket by the door.
So, I said, you went to Nordhausen.
He shook his head, but he was going to give way. We both knew it.
Yes, God damn it, I went to Nordhausen,
he said in a tone that sounded more defeated than angry. At that moment, I knew, knowing nothing, that it had been the worst place on earth, and a part of my nature that had lain dormant for a long time snapped open like an eye. I had been raised among quiet people who repressed their emotions. I knew my father to have been a big talker, a bullshit artist, and an epithet I remembered hearing my grandfather throw in his face, a lover boy. But that was hearsay, and given his record, distinctly an argument in favor of repression. I was aware that in some remote age, my grandmother had been a source of fire, madness, and poetry. But those days were misty legend. One could only infer them from traces in the geological record. In my family, in my lifetime, we preferred to leave the business of feeling and talking about feeling to people with nothing better to do. Youthful rebellion, therefore, had required my wholehearted embrace of poetry, fire, and madness, and all of those, Rimbaud, Patti Smith, Syd Barrett, the girls I went after, who trafficked in them. Long after rebellion cooled, I flew the flag of self-expression. I had emerged into adolescence toward the end of the 70s. That great unbuttoning. As I came into young manhood, the ascendant recovery movement was at work, normalizing the idea that redemption lay in the sharing of experience and feeling, and that in denial there was something like damnation. Right up to that afternoon at my grandfather's bedside, prodding him to tell me about Nordhausen and the beefy young blonde man, I believed, and for the most part believe still, that silence was darkness, and that naming shone a light. I believed that a secret was like a malignancy, and a confession, a knife. a bright, hot beam of radiation that healed as it burned. I believed it was good, this being among the few things that truly did go without saying, to get it all out. Then I heard the bitterness of defeat in my grandfather's voice when he said that he had gone to Nordhausen. I thought about how, when I was a kid, as my big-talking, sweet-talking, fast-talking father was in and out of courtrooms, tax dodges, marriages, and my life, the constancy of my grandfather's silence had been just that, a constant. It was, like him, something I could always rely on. And really, where was the proof that 2 decades of national yammering, of getting it all out, had brought about an increase in collective national happiness? I had recently read something in Scientific American about the Roman city of Herculaneum, buried by Vesuvius, uncovered by archaeologists, how exposure to light and air was destroying what centuries of darkness had preserved. And radiation treatment? A textbook example of a situation where the cure was worse than the disease. On balance, most of the time, in the ordinary course of life, it was probably best to say what was in your heart, to share what was on your mind, to tell the people you loved that you loved them, to ask those you had harmed to forgive you and to confront those who had hurt you with the truth about the damage they had done. When it came to things that needed to be said, speech was always preferable to silence. But it was of no use at all in the presence of the unspeakable. "I think maybe I'll have a little soup after all," my grandfather said. I went into the kitchen and ladled some of my mother's chicken soup into a bowl from the big Tupperware in the refrigerator. While the soup heated in the microwave, I opened the legs of the breakfast tray and wiped it down with 409. I folded a napkin and set a spoon on the napkin. I found the salt and pepper shakers shaped like terriers, one white, one black. Sometimes my grandfather liked to sprinkle his soup with those little yellow Israeli soup croutons. He called them mandolin, and so for the extra calories I poured a handful into a saucer and set that on the tray. When the soup was hot, I eased it from the microwave to the tray and carried the tray to the bedroom. The broth was gold, the carrot and celery and onion were gems. A filigree of golden fat adorned the surface. In the steam, coming off the bowl of soup was the hint of lemon, a memory of my grandmother. Really, it smelled very good. I got him propped up and into position. Then I set the tray across his body and tucked the napkin into the collar of the long T-shirt he wore. He leaned forward to put his face, his nostrils, in the path of the steam, coming off the bowl. He closed his eyes and inhaled. He picked up the spoon, and I watched him put away most of the bowl. The taste of it seemed to come as a kind of relief. "Okay," he said. He put down his spoon. "Werner Magnus Maximilian Frère von Braun." After the name, he added something acrid in Yiddish. "All I got was onion," I said. "Something your great-grandmother used to say, a Yiddish curse. He should grow with his head in the dirt like an onion. That's what's going on there?" I picked up the copy of Rockets, Missiles, and Space Travel, purloined 30-odd years earlier from the library of the Wallkill Prison. In the Willie Ley book, somebody blotted von Braun's name out over and over again. "Me," he said, adding dryly. "It didn't work." He sprinkled a few mandolin onto the soup and took another spoonful. I heard the tiny crackers crunch between his teeth. "And then I remember how you wouldn't watch the moon landing, how you got up and left the room, even though that was pretty much something you had been waiting your whole life to see."
"Yeah."
"Did that have something to do with your feelings about von Braun?"
"Yeah."
"So, obviously, something must have happened." Another spoonful of soup went into his mouth. He swallowed it. His eyes were fixed on mine, watchful and withholding, challenging me to justify the logic of my inference. "Because that morning when you took off on that motorcycle, it sounded like, at that point, you were feeling almost like you and von Braun were..."
"Kindred spirits?"
"Yeah. But then, later, at a certain point,
He was still watching me with less apparent tenderness than I could ever remember having seen in his eyes. He had put down his spoon.
"It kind of seems like you pretty much decided you hated the guy's guts."
"Pretty much," he agreed.
"Why?"
When I was a boy and fell prey to what he regarded as an inherent weakness for stating the obvious, my grandfather had a certain voice he would use to repeat whatever I had just said. To me, it sounded like the voice that Mel Blanc used to do dim-witted bloodhounds, yetis, and muscle-bound dumbasses in the old Warner Brothers cartoons. My grandfather probably thought of it as the voice of Lon Chaney, Jr., playing Lenny and of Mice and Men. I had not heard it in a very long time, but now it resurfaced, stammering, at once low-pitched and infantile.
"Something must have happened," he said in his moron voice.
I waited. He picked up the spoon and tilted the bowl toward himself. It looked like he was going to polish off the rest of it. I imagined the account I would make to my mother when she got home from work. "He loved the soup. I got him to eat a whole bowl." There was a clang as he flung down the spoon. In a man so frail and narcotized, the gesture felt inordinately violent. He pushed the bowl away. Later I would find a chip missing from its rim.
"You want to know what happened at Nordhausen?" he said in his regular rasp. "Look it up!"
Chapter 22. When my mother got home, I went down to the library, a storybook-style cottage on Mountain Boulevard that stayed open late on Thursday nights. I started with Gravity's Rainbow, which I had read at UC Irvine for Mike Clark's graduate seminar on the modern novel, and which was, the accurately researched it turned out, source of most of the little I had ever known about the V2. I spent an hour flipping through and skimming the relevant passages, starting with the book's epigraph, then following its secondary character of Franz Pulkler, a young engineer whose career traces the history of spaceflight in Germany, the Weimar period of Rocketport Berlin, and the starry-eyed Verein für Raumschifffahrt, Frau im Mond and the rocket craze, the militarization of rocket research that came with Hitler's rise, Peenemünde, and, I was jolted to discover, Nordhausen, where the book's protagonist Tyrone Slothrop also turned up at one point. I remembered having read these passages, some absurd, some harrowing, set in and around the rocket's mountain lair, but the name of the site in the Harz Mountains had gone out of my memory completely. I wondered if my grandfather knew or had ever tried to read Gravity's Rainbow. I wondered how he would have felt about the book's depictions of the European theater of operations, the horror of Nordhausen, the experience of rocket attacks, and so many other things Pynchon had never lived through or seen. It all felt convincing to me, but what did I know? Apart from so-called hard science fiction, which he read, as with The Magic Mountain, for its artful packaging of big ideas, my grandfather regarded most fiction as a bunch of baloney. He thought reading novels was a waste of time more profitably spent on nonfiction. Beyond the Pynchon, there was not a lot. A brief Britannica entry on Nordhausen and its Mittelwerk rocket factory, cross-referenced to entries on the V2, the facility at Peenemünde, and the Dora Mittelbau concentration camp. Mentions of Peenemünde, the Mittelwerk, and KZ Dora Mittelbau in a few general histories of World War II. Some of the grimmest pages, toward the end, in a book about the 3rd Armored Division's year-long slog from Normandy to Dessau. A Pentagon-approved 1971 book on Operation Paperclip that made careful reference to the 1947 acquittal on charges of war crimes of a V-2 project middle manager named Georg Rikai. Finally, the jackpot, an article in the New York Times from March 1984, which I read on microfilm. It summarized an exposé of Operation Paperclip in the latest issue of Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists. The author of the exposé, the Times said, had made extensive use of formally classified documents released under the Freedom of Information Act to establish in detail that the post-war history of American technological accomplishment, particularly in the realm of biological warfare, aeronautics, and spaceflight, had been rooted in heinous Nazi war crimes and an elaborate American cover-up of those crimes.
Following decades of inaction and denial, the article said, the U.S. government had stripped the citizenship of a prominent rocket scientist, Arthur Rudolph, and deported him to his native Germany. Rudolph had declined or been unable to contest direct evidence linking him to numerous atrocities during his tenure as managing director of V2 production at Nordhausen. Along with Wernher von Braun, the article said, Arthur Rudolph had been the lead designer of the mighty Saturn V, the rocket that had borne the Apollo missions toward the moon. Altogether, it was not a lot, but I got the general drift. Until August 1943, the plan was for V-2 rockets to be manufactured, once they became operational, at the same top-secret facility on the remote island of Peenemünde off the German Baltic coast, where their research and development had been carried out. The prototypes and test rockets had all been manufactured in Peenemünde's workshops by hundreds of foreign workers, prisoners housed in an adjacent concentration camp, most of them Poles. The prisoners had already begun construction of a new factory when, during the full moon of August 17th, Peenemünde became the target of a massive Allied air raid. The secret of Peenemünde had been discovered, intelligence gathered, reconnaissance carried out. The aim of the raid, codenamed Hydra, and the hope of its planners, among them Churchill's son-in-law Duncan Sandys, was to strangle the V-2, or A-4 as it was known then, in its cradle. To that end, 600 Lancasters, Halifaxes, and Stirlings dropped 2 million kilograms of high-explosive bombs in what was believed to be the general vicinity of the workshops, the experimental stations, and the living quarters of the scientists and engineers. At that time, the science of bomb targeting was less than precise. As the raid unfolded over Peenemünde, errors, navigational, calculative, aeronautical, compounded. While measurable damage was done to the workshops and experimental stations, the greatest part of the bombs that did not fall harmlessly fell onto the adjacent concentration camp. 700 of the foreign workers died within a few minutes. German researchers killed by the bombs of Hydra numbered 2. Afterward, both Allied and German damage assessments agreed that the raid, which also cost the lives of 200 British airmen, had set the rocket program back by 8 weeks, at most. If Hydra had been ineffective, it was not without result. The V-2 program was now demonstrably vulnerable, and Heinrich Himmler seized on that vulnerability to bring it under control of his SS, in which Wernher von Braun had risen to the rank of Sturmbannführer. Clearly, the projected factory was at grave risk. It could not be built on an expanse of open seacoast at coordinates well known to the enemy. It must be moved and protected against further attack. It would be kept secret, as Peenemünde had been, but that was insufficient. The factory must be hidden as well. A new site, the Mittelwerk, was commissioned and constructed in the Harz Mountains, just outside the town of Nordhausen. In a display of the kind of inventive audacity that characterized German military research, the new rocket factory was constructed inside of a minor mountain. Fresh gangs of Poles, along with Frenchmen, Russians, Czechs, and Ukrainians, prisoners of war, political prisoners, were conscripted from KZ Buchenwald, 50 miles away, and detailed to excavate and expand a tunnel system under the Konstein, site of a disused gypsum mine. The Mittelwerk's lattice of tunnels served as a factory floor, administrative offices, staff dormitory, and at first as a subterranean concentration camp for the laborers who worked, ate, slept, and died in them. When they died, their bodies were shipped back to Buchenwald for cremation. A steadily increasing rate of V-2 production demanded more inmates than the Mittelwerk could accommodate. The SS forced the prisoners to build a camp for themselves outside the south entrance to the tunnels, codenamed Dora, which in time spawned further sub-camps centered around the Mittelwerk and known collectively as Mittelbau. A sub-camp in the town of Nordhausen, called the Belke Kaserne, was used as a dumping ground for inmates too enfeebled or sick to work. From the start of excavation and the first shipments of Buchenwald prisoners in September 1943 until the capture of the Mittelwerk and the liberation of Dora Mittelbau in April 1945, an estimated 60,000 prisoners were put to work building the 7,000 V-2s that eventually rolled off the line.
the men who built the rockets, lived in filth, underfed, malnourished, and brutalized. Packed into the barracks of Dora in their striped uniforms, in bunks stacked four high, the workers froze in the winter, roasted in the summer, and died by the tens of thousands all year round. They were worked beyond their capacity to endure in primitive and dangerous conditions. The tunnels were hot, dark, cramped, crowded. They were filled with fumes, smoke, and the racket of machinery. Discipline was severe, and the guards bestial. Minor infractions were punished by kicking, beating, torture, mutilation. Fear of insurrection resulted in regular mass executions. The condemned would be hanged six at a time from a massive crane used to transport rocket assemblies from one part of the line to the next, in full view of the workers on the factory floor and of the project's scientists and engineers from von Braun on down the line. Bodies were left to dangle instructively overhead. Sabotage, though subject to swift and savage retribution, was rife and, along with the abysmal conditions and demoralized workforce, may have led directly to the relatively high rate of failure experienced by the V-2. In time, a crematorium was built at Dora to save the trouble and expense of sending dead inmates all the way to Buchenwald. The 104th Infantry, Timberwolf, and the 3rd Armored Spearhead Divisions rolled into Nordhausen on April 11, 1945, and found it abandoned by the enemy. They stumbled first across the subcamp in the town itself. Ravaged by an untreated outbreak of typhus, the Bulka Kaserne had also borne the brunt of an Allied air raid the week before that killed 1,500 inmates and wounded hundreds more. The death marches, forced transports, mass burials, and other attempts by the evacuating Germans to conceal the enormity of Nordhausen had left only the most enfeebled and grievously maimed in the Bulka Kaserne. The liberators had not even begun to grasp what they were seeing when they came upon Dora. These were among the first U.S. troops to enter a concentration camp. Photographs and film footage they took there featured in newsreels and on front pages all over the world. Even after the name and the business of Nordhausen had been carefully mislaid by history, at least in the adopted homeland of Werner von Braun, the imagery of its horror endured. The dead ranged in corduroy roads to the vanishing point, bone men slumped and staring. In the tunnels under Konstein Mountain, among incomplete rocket assemblies and machines left running, the liberators found the men of the Mittelwerk's final shift, abandoned by their captors, too weak to move, let alone try to escape. Heaps of sticks atop which solemn heads stood regarding them like owls. In the infirmary, the bodies of the Mittelwerk's last-on-the-job fatalities lay naked on tile slabs, drained of blood and awaiting transport to the crematorium. Having come 600 miles through some of the most brutal combat and one of the bitterest European winters of the 20th century, the liberators were as inured to the routine of battlefield horror as any men have ever been obliged to become. When they saw what there was to see in the camps and under Konstein Mountain, according to their own subsequent accounts followed closely by Pynchon when he had his engineer Polkler tour KZ Dora, a considerable number of these men, with their thousand-yard stares, broke down in tears or turned away to vomit. The liberators could not have endured so long and so much, however, without having learned the knack of repressing futile emotion. They soon moved on to anger and a desire to impose some measure of justice, or, failing that, retribution, if clear distinction could be made between the two. They looked around for someone to lay their hands on. The SS guards and functionaries had all fled the area, along with the Mittelwerk's personnel. I couldn't find anything to suggest that the liberators contemplated trying to punish or even gave much thought to the brains of the operation, the men with slide rules and soldering irons whose great invention, only incidentally the first long-range ballistic missile, was a process by which horror could be converted into terror by dint of cruelty. At any rate, had the liberators of Dora made this imaginative leap, there would have been no way to act upon it. Von Braun's rocketeers were miles away, scattered across southern Germany and Austria. In the end, the townsmen paid the debt of horror. The liberators returned to Nordhausen from Dora and the Mittelwerk, rousted the men from their houses, and ordered them at gunpoint to fetch shovels and start digging until all the dead of KZ Dora Mittelbau were buried. That is what I found in the public record that night at the Montclair Public Library when I went to look up Nordhausen. Between the impressment of the local citizens as gravediggers and the beginning of the end of my grandfather's war, I can offer only informed speculation, combined with a few little facts that he inadvertently dropped over the course of the next few days. I know that he arrived at Nordhausen the day after its liberation, along with the news that FDR was dead. He steered the Zundapp through the empty streets of the town. With every barrier lifted and every gateway open to him as a result of his Eisenhower pass, he had no trouble entering the various subcamps or the factory under the mountain. Like the men of the Timberwolf and Spearhead divisions, he had been hardened by prolonged exposure to violence. Like them, I imagine, what he saw around Dora Mittelbau may have brought him to the point of tears or nausea. It was clear, from what he told me afterward, that, like the liberators, he looked around to find a fitting object of his rage when his tour of this particular hell and its environs was complete. What he saw that day and what he heard from the survivors he questioned persuaded him that there was no way Wernher von Braun could have been technical director of the V-2 program while remaining unaware of how business was conducted in the Mittelwerk. Von Braun could not be crowned with the glory of the rocket without shouldering the burden of its shame. All the suffering my grandfather saw had been amassed, and all the cruelty deployed at the prompting and in the service of von Braun's dream. It turned out that the V-2 was not a means to liberate the human spirit from the chains of gravity. It was only a pretext for further enchainment. It was not an express bound for the stars, but a mail rocket carrying one simple message, signed in high-explosive amatol with the name of Baron von Braun. Maybe the man's dream had begun as something beautiful and grand. For a time, maybe, its grandeur and its beauty had blinded von Braun to all the ways in which he was busily betraying it. That was only human, the common lot. But once your dream revealed itself, like most dreams, to be nothing but a current of raw compulsion flowing through a circuitry of delusion and lies, then that was the time to give it up. That was the time to damn your dream and trust your eyes, and maybe cock your revolver. Over the course of that long day in Nordhausen, my grandfather trusted his eyes and gave up the dream he had shared with the Wernher von Braun of his imaginings. Along with it, he surrendered the memory of a rocket and a clearing, a half hour of something that had felt like peace, a midnight conversation with the rector of Our Lady of the Moon. When those things were gone, there was a bad moment as my grandfather found himself confronted once more with the void that surrounded the planet of his heart for 1,000 parsecs in every direction. After that, as with the liberators of Nordhausen putting away their disgust and useless anguish, there was only the matter of his anger, and where to point it. "I went to track him down," my grandfather said, "like I was supposed to, more or less." "More or less? Well, I wasn't supposed to go solo, but that doesn't make any sense to me under the circumstances." I wasn't sure whether he was talking about a specific local set of circumstances or the general ones under which, like some gumshoe, he always preferred to work alone. He had made an exception in the case of Auenbau. He would never entirely recover from the lapse. I nodded, but I must have looked confused. "The circumstances being that when I found him, I was planning to, you know," he said.
"Kill the guy?"
"Right."
On the other hand, I did have a fair amount of latitude. I had an Eisenhower pass, signed by Ike himself. All of us CIOS guys did. "I had been given a degree of discretion," he said, "which I totally abused."
Chapter 23.
In the town of Nordhausen, an intelligence officer attached to the 3rd Armored Division told my grandfather of being approached by one of the locals, who had hinted that he might be persuaded to betray certain of his neighbors. This fellow did not know exactly what behaviors the Americans might be looking to punish, or secrets they hoped to extract, but he was certain they would find something in his inventory to suit their needs. He kept a shop in town that, appropriately enough, sold hunting and fishing gear. In the early morning of his second day in Nordhausen, my grandfather went to the shop with cigarettes, Spam, chocolate, and, he recalled, a miraculous bunch of bananas, the hand of a golden Buddha ablaze against the gray morning. He found the shop on a street that bore signs of damage from the RAF raid the previous week, the one that had killed 1,500 inmates of the Belka Kaserne. The shop had 2 display windows. One was covered over with a stained oilcloth tarpaulin. The other was intact, but its shade had been lowered to hide or spare the passerby from having to see that there was nothing to display. If you turned around, you could see a corner of the walls of the Belka Kaserne rising down at the end of the street. No doubt it had carried sounds and odors to the doorstep when the wind was right. My grandfather went around to the back door. He did not care if his visit endangered the shopkeeper's life, but he wanted it to seem as though he did. He rang the bell and showed his Eisenhower pass. They spoke in riddles and allusions, and then the shopkeeper let him in. The shopkeeper explained to my grandfather that he belonged to some minor Christian sect that had been first frowned on and then harassed by the Reich. Recently, his stock of excellent Mannlicher rifles had been requisitioned by the local Volkssturm during a short-lived moment of planned resistance, in exchange for worthless promissory notes. He was garrulous and priggish, and it was a wonder his neighbors had not done away with him years ago. He turned down the cigarettes and chocolate as immoral indulgences. The bananas and Spam were welcome enough, but struck the shopkeeper as perhaps, on their own, inadequate payment. My grandfather said that if his question got a useful answer, he would try to come up with a few more cans of Spam and maybe a tub or two of corn syrup. If that would not do, my grandfather proposed hanging the shopkeeper by the ears on a couple of fishhooks from his heaviest gauge fishing line, giving him a push to get him swinging, and inviting those neighbors whom the shopkeeper was so eager to betray to come and test their marksmanship using whatever blunderbusses the Volkssturm had left on the shelves. A breeze blew in through the smashed window. Tarpaulin rustled and snapped like a sail. The shopkeeper suggested that my grandfather try the Herzog farm on the road to Sondershausen. Herzog was an infantryman killed during the course of the long retreat from Italy. His widow had taken up with one Stolzmann, an engineer from the Mittelwerk who was now living at the farm and posing as Herzog. My grandfather rode the Zund up out to the Herzog farm. The sidecar rode empty beside him. He crossed a stream and, just before the road, made a bend to the south, entered a birchwood. The birches congregated in the fog, wrapped in their bark with its cryptic inscriptions. They reminded my grandfather of monuments in a graveyard. He felt a premonitory shiver and, a second later, a sharp tug at the left elbow of his army coat. He heard a crack of rifle fire, small caliber by the sound. Someone was shooting at him from the cover of the trees north of the road. My grandfather glanced back and to his left but saw only trees and a bright dot of daylight in the wool at the elbow of his coat. My grandfather felt foolish, which bothered him, since he would prefer to die in the grip of any emotion, no matter how abject, than in the knowledge of his own stupidity. If the dealer in sporting goods would betray his own neighbors for some canned ham and bananas, then it was likely he would not hesitate to betray an American soldier for less. The bastard probably had arranged for an ad hoc ambush as soon as my grandfather left the shop. My grandfather opened the throttle and let the beautiful engine do what its designers had engineered it to do. There was another rifle crack, but this time the shot went wide. The road left the birch wood and made its bend to the south. There was no more shooting after that. When he saw the promised farmhouse and its stand of poplars about a quarter mile ahead on the left, he slowed the motorcycle and killed its engine. The farm had the appearance of prosperity, neither untouched nor entirely diminished by war. The stucco farmhouse was large and new,
with a second story and signs of modern plumbing. The large ground-floor windows had leaded lozenges in their upper panes. There was half-timbering, a red-tiled roof, and an overall air of ersatz medievalism that my grandfather supposed to be good Nazi style. The barn was capacious, with a metal roof and fine repair. The Alsatian bitch, who came bounding and chesty across the meadow to give my grandfather a piece of her mind, had a lustrous coat. It had been a long time since my grandfather had seen a civilian dog who did not slink around corners with the rib cage visible and the head lowered in shame or calculation. This bold specimen was, frankly, asking to be shot. But in addition to the headless officer's rifle and Walter, my grandfather had come armed with a small can of Vienna sausages. After a moment's quick work with the can opener of his folding knife, a truce was agreed to. My grandfather fed the sausages to the dog at one-minute intervals, until he gained some measure of adoration. She followed him to the house, but gave no warning of his approach until he was almost to the kitchen door. In the spotless kitchen, he found Frau Herzog, trying to help a boy of 9 or 10 to adjust his artificial leg. She was a good-looking woman with a remarkable bosom who displayed mild anxiety at an American officer's sudden appearance in her dooryard, but nothing that was not called for. She explained that the boy, her son, suffered from diabetes, and regrettably would have to decline the proffered Hershey bars. The boy, fair and slender, stared at my grandfather, fear showing unbribed and plain on his face. The bulb of his stump reminded my grandfather of the nose cone of a V2. The skin over it looked chafed and sore. The prosthesis was too big, too long. At one time it might have been the property of another larger amputee child. My grandfather had planned on confronting the widow Herzog to cut the bullshit and just ask for Stoltzmann. But he was derailed by something in the face, or the gestalt of the wide-eyed, silent boy with his legs dying out from under him. "Herr Herzog?" my grandfather inquired. Alarm deepened the groove between Frau Herzog's eyebrows. She apologized. She said that she hoped there was nothing amiss. She said that her husband was an infantryman and that he had stepped on a mine, a German mine, in a place called San Gimignano. Now he was out of combat and of no danger to anyone. In the midst of making this statement, she glanced at the boy. My grandfather did not hear a lie in her voice, but noted the ambiguous phrasing. If her husband was dead and she was covering up for this Stoltzmann, my grandfather could not help but admire her apparent reluctance to tell an out-and-out lie in front of her child. "My business is not with your husband," he said, answering her ambiguity with his own. "I'm in a hurry and would like nothing better than to leave all of you in peace as soon as I have the answer I need." The bitch came in through the open door and, with a loving tongue, addressed herself to the fingers my grandfather had used to serve the Vienna sausages. She sat down at my grandfather's side and yawned. Frau Herzog stood with her arms folded under her bosom, which my grandfather could not help but admire, too. He could see that although it was likely she had never wanted anything more than she wanted him to leave them in peace, that would still be insufficient payment, in her view, for what he was asking in return. Then he thought of something she might want even more. "I can get you insulin," he said, "say 3 months' supply, if the man of the house answers my question." Frau Herzog carried the boy to the bench of the refectory table and posed him there with the leg beside him. "6 months," she said. She led him out to the barn, where a man dressed in duck overalls was busy delivering a pair of calves, so persuasively that my grandfather began to doubt the information he had been given by the shopkeeper. The overalls fit, and so did the face, lean and raw-boned, with patient blue eyes. Before Frau Herzog called out to him and interrupted his work, the man's face wore an expression of blissful absorption in the procedure and its proper execution, usual enough with engineers, but presumably not unknown among farmers. The man in the overalls inquired as to the nature of my grandfather's business. My grandfather turned to Frau Herzog. Speaking in the most formal German he could muster,
he made the polite suggestion that her son was no doubt wondering when she would be returning to the kitchen. He made the deliberate mistake of addressing her as Frau Stutzmann. A blush filled in the pale skin between her freckles.